Good morning. We're the Historians. I'm Jay Sammons here with my longtime friend and Boston University colleague, Professor Brendan McConville.
Coming to you from the shadow of Bellevue Hill, we are back, baby, after a little bit of a long break.
And back on the banks of the virtual Charles, coming to you, ready to tell you about history and the life of two aging historians.
Right. Two middle-aged men who are historically obsessed.
Rapidly aging, I might
add. Rapidly aging, yes.
Well, yes, we've been on something of a hiatus due to having to finish our courses from the fall of 2020, teaching through the pandemic electronically and in person. Both of us were. And we finished all our grading. And how did your students do last semester?
I was a little bit more generous grading than I normally am, which is usually not generous at all.
Yeah. In other words, you were just harsh instead of confiscatory.
In other words, there was probably 15% A grades, which normally there would be less than 10%, you know. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's very vigorous, so, you know, very rigorous and vigorous.
Yeah.
I just thought it was hard on the students, and I had more sympathy for them because, you know, half of them were learning in strange situations, and many of them were not in the classroom. And
it's an interesting approach. Sympathy for students.
I know.
I've never tried it.
As you know, I don't go that way often, you know, but
I may try it sometime. I'll think about it. I think actually we're both very sympathetic to our students. We're just harsh graders. We hold them to high standards.
I think holding them to high standards, making demands on them, calling them on them, not just to expect to have, you know, the text explained to them, but for them to read the text and extract from it. Isn't that what we're paid for?
Yes. And it shows them respect.
It shows them respect.
Yeah.
As young scholars and young people, we're going to have to confront a complicated and complex world, obviously.
Absolutely. Well, and if you're going to confront a complicated world, you need a good breakfast.
You do.
So what are you having this morning, Professor McConville?
I cannot escape the firm clutches of the carbohydrate.
Oh, yeah. You love your carbs, man.
I want my bagel, garlic bagel with some butter, but I am having three strips of bacon to go with it.
Nice.
To include the other white meat.
Yeah, pork. Yeah, I'm gonna make some pork tonight, I think, but I'll have some now. I'm gonna have bacon and eggs, and I think I'll have my eggs over easy and some well done hash browns going with that. Home fries, you know.
Home fry. Oh, love them. Love them.
Oh, my goodness. That's my weakness is potatoes, honestly. And I don't let myself have them that often, but I could live on potatoes.
I claim that. As an Irishman, I claim that influence on you.
I guess that's what happened.
Yeah, but I love potatoes too. I love a baked potato or a fried potato. Yeah. Love them.
Yeah, I guess I get your love of potato. I get love of potatoes through my friendship with you and my attraction to whiskey through my Scottish heritage.
Right.
So back now that we're back in the saddle in January of 2021. We've been talking about doing an in-depth series of shows on a subject that we know everyone in the Boston area can't get enough of. And that's
many people can't.
That subject is
Ireland.
Ireland and the Irish. I was going to say Tom Brady for a second, but Ireland and the Irish. Well, Brady, he's probably Irish, isn't he?
I think I read once that he's half Irish and half German, and clearly his tallness and lack of a round head comes from not being Irish, you know?
isn't his wife half German, too?
His wife is German, Brazilian of German descent.
By the way, if his wife's half German and he's half German, does that make their kids fully German?
No. Well, the thing is, his wife is Brazilian, as Brazil, like the United States, has people from all over the place. You know,
it's only a joke. It makes their kids French. Everybody knows that,
right? French, okay. Yes. French, not French, Jay. French speaking.
Right. Gallophones.
Gallophones.
Yeah. All right. So we're going to talk about the history of the Troubles in Ireland. And before we started today, you said we're going to go get deep background, and I know a little bit about prehistorical and early historical Ireland. So this could be an interesting segment here, this section on the background of the Troubles in Ireland.
Well, one of the things that I thought when we did the episode, particularly on the Irish War of Independence, the Irish Revolution against British authority, is that the episode was too compacted. And that episode has always bothered me because I thought, okay, we're just trying to jam. I tried to jam too much stuff into that and it disturbed me. So we're going to, right now, we're going to look, it does. That episode, I've never been happy with it. I want to redo it. It's not, you know.
I feel that way about all the episodes.
Well, I
at least
I
the ones I'm in
right.
Know, sort of, yeah, charge of. Yeah.
It's hard because of the way our time works and everything else. So I thought that, look, something as complex and emotional as what happened in Northern Ireland in the last half of the, you know, last quarter of the 20th century, last from the 1960s into basically to today, you know, is still till today, with so many people in the Boston area who have ties to Ireland, who are of Irish descent or are born in Ireland.
Yeah.
I wanted to give us more room. And so we're going to do a couple episodes. Right now I'm thinking at least three and perhaps four episodes on what happens in Northern Ireland in that period, which becomes so important to, you know, the history of Great Britain, the history of Ireland, the history of the United States, and the history of other peoples as well. And it really is a kind of central thing that happens. And I did want to start today by going back and sort of showing where does the division of Ireland come from? And what's the character of the area in the north before the division? What's the character, you know, after the 1920s when the division comes into, you know, formal being? Why is there a division made? And then what is the politics going forward from that period of division that lead up to the early and mid 1960s when what becomes known as the Troubles in Northern Ireland, when they begin, and they don't begin, you know, they begin in many respects as part of a civil rights movement among Catholics in the north of Ireland,
right,
trying to get voting rights and economic rights.
Right. I just wanted to say that one of the reasons I there's lots of reasons I find this subject fascinating, but one of the reasons I think it's important is because we're leading into events that happened in our lifetime. We were both born in the 60s. And right into the modern era, we see the effect that religious belief and differences and traditions can have on actual, you know, political life, public life, social life. And I think a lot of people today, our students maybe especially, sort of see religion as something that, well, that's not really relevant to the real world, you know, but it is.
very relevant to the real world.
Yeah. So this is a good subject for showing that.
Yeah. Going back, as I really did think about it, it really does run to our own time. The North had since medieval times been a distinct region, is known as Ulster. It was not six counties, it was nine, what become nine counties. Basically the top quarter, third of the island of Ireland. It had its own clans, its own distinctive chiefs. The most famous from the medieval period is Niall of the Nine Hostages. He's a very unpleasant fellow. He raided in Scotland. He did all kinds of horrible things.
And haven't you told me before that a huge percentage of modern Irish are descended from this guy?
Yeah, including almost everyone named McNeil or O'Neill. They're all apparently descended from this guy.
He was Niall of the Nine Hostages and the thousands of descendants.
Right. Tens of thousands of descendants. Also, many people in Scotland are descended from him, too. Apparently.
And just to be clear, this difference had nothing to do with ethnicity at this point. It's just clans.
They're clans just, and different groups.
Okay, it's not.
I mean, there is linguistic differences, different dialects of Irish Gaelic and across the way, Scottish Gaelic, obviously. That part of the country suffered heavy Viking incursions, and there was Viking, you know, settlements there, and of course, Viking influence in terms of genetic influence. The North was the area, incidentally, early in the medieval and in the early modern period that led the resistance to the Norman, you know, English Norman invasion, basically, the Normans who had conquered England. They were the ones who intruded into Ireland, and the North, you know, in the medieval period, and the North was one of the leading, you know, was the most staunchly Catholic area. At that time, they were all Catholics anyway.
So I don't think I even realized that the Normans already had invaded Ireland. What, in the 11th or in the 12th or 13th
in
century?
In the 12th century, basically,
okay.
It gets heavy. You know, it gets to be and they try to establish themselves basically in Eastern Ireland. With very mixed success. I mean,
Brendan, was there already a Scots influence in Northern Ireland at this point? Or was it the other way around? The Irish were going into Scotland.
In other words, you can see, if you look at a map, that there's not much. You can see Scotland from Northern Ireland. So there was back and forth, both trade and raiding and warfare going back and forth.
And the Gaelic speakers on both sides of that.
Right, although different versions of Gaelic. Mm-hmm. But in regard to where we are now, I think that the key reign is the reign of Elizabeth, who we talked about when we talked about our Tudor dynasty in our Tudor dynasty episode. Elizabeth, because the North was had fought against, you know, English control, Elizabeth was keen to get the northern part of Ireland under control. There was rebellions in the North. The most famous of these was called the 9 Year War against Elizabeth's control in Ireland. The 9 Year War was led by the Northern clans. And so one of the things that she did as they defeated those clans in the 9 Years War was invite Protestants, particularly Scottish Protestants from the Scottish lowlands, to move into Northern Ireland to settle there. And in effect, to control or displace those Northern Irish Catholics. There was, by this point, a religious division. There were Protestant. She was a Protestant. Many people in the south of England were Protestant. Many lowland Scots had adopted Presbyterianism under the influence of John Knox by this point. They began to move into Northern Ireland. And this creates the basis. They're not the only Protestants who move there, not the only English people who move there. But this creates the basis, of the religious difference of the North, which was far more heavily Protestant than there was, that begins that cultural and spiritual mm-hmm. division in Ireland in a very sort of concrete way. There was a stream of settlers that come from Scotland with, quite frankly, the opportunity of we're going to seize some land and hold it and control it, which is, of course, the norm of the 16th and 17th centuries.
So they displaced some Irish Catholics at that point and took some of their land.
They displaced them. That was further intensified under the reign of Cromwell. Of course, there was the Irish rebelled against English rule in that period of the English Civil Wars in the early 1640s. In response, Cromwell ends up massacring or displacing many Irish Catholics. Of course, he was a virulent anti-Catholic, as were many of the Puritan leaders of the English South. They were virulently anti-Catholic. Many Catholics were displaced and driven into the western parts of Ireland. There was more settlement of Protestants then at that time. There was another wave of Protestants at the end of the 17th century, including many French Protestant Huguenots who had fled to England after Louis XIV revoked the Edict of Nantes, which was the Edict of Toleration of Protestants in France. Many of them fled to England and Scotland, and then they moved to Ireland, both Dublin and the area around Belfast. And so there was very considerable Protestant influx into the eastern portion of Ireland, particularly the northeast.
I know my questions are keeping you from going as swiftly as you'd like to go with this, but I really want to get this square for me and for our listeners. The North was heavily settled with Protestants because it was a locus of rebellion and resistance to the English, felt like.
Yes.
So ironically enough, they're putting more Protestants there, which is going to lead to more rebellion in the North eventually.
More unhappiness. Yeah. More unhappiness. And of course, there were a series of rebellions in the 18th century in Ireland, not necessarily in the North. The most famous of which was 1798, which is in some people in Ireland called the Year of the French, when they got assistance from the French to some degree and wanted a French expeditionary army to land in Ireland to help them throw off a British control. There was a series of rebellions. Some of them are along religious lines. Some of them are not. And one of the interesting things that I think our listeners will be, sort of fascinated by is that many leaders of Irish national movements in the 17th, 18th, 19th centuries were Protestants. And many people who advocated for Catholic emancipation while remaining in the British Empire part of Britain were Protestants as well. Most famously, Edmund Burke. We're up on our first break. We'll be right back. We're the historians.
Hi, this is Mike DeStacio, host of Real Talk with the Hollywood Kid. Join me every Saturday from 2 to 3 when I'll be interviewing some of the biggest stars in showbiz right here on the legendary airwaves of AM 1550 And you can also stream us worldwide at WNTN 1550AM.com. You can climb a
mountain. You can swim the sea. All right, we're back. We're the historians. We're talking about Ireland and the coming of the Troubles in Ireland. We got up to around 1800. You mentioned Edmund Burke, the famous conservative English statesman. And what I wondered, Brendan, is can you just remind us what is the exact political relationship between Ireland and England at this time?
Well, why that's such a great question is that at this moment it's changing. Up until then, Ireland had its own parliament. Now, that parliament was almost exclusively Protestant, if not exclusively Protestant. I believe it was exclusively Protestant. Catholics were denied the franchise. They had been forced off the land. They were forced into tenancy or just simply forced to the West Country. What happens is in part because of the 1798 rebellion, the British government basically does away with the Irish parliament. And then Ireland is given seats in the English, the British parliament. Yeah. But there, at that time, the franchise is effectively restricted to Protestants. In fact, I think it formally restricted to Protestants.
When Ireland had its own parliament, did it have its own cabinet too, prime minister, et cetera, or?
No, it had a Lord Lieutenant, I believe.
Okay. So it was a British official sent to Ireland.
Right, if I'm remembering that correctly. So I don't have that right in front of me, but I believe that's correct. And it's a British official, yeah. And I mean, that parliament was seen as being subordinate to the British parliament, just as the assemblies of the American colonies at the time of their rebellion was seen as being subordinate. Of course, Scotland had its own parliament until 1707, 1708, when it was, they joined or forced. They didn't force, but they were joined in with the British parliament. And this was seen as a form of control, but the Catholics were not enfranchised.
Okay, so Catholics not enfranchised, not able to sit in Parliament, not even able to vote. But Catholics in England in the late 1700s, could Catholics in England sit in the English Parliament?
That's a good question. I don't know the answer to that.
Because they can in the late 1800s. They definitely can.
Right. In the late 19th century, you mean?
In the late 19th century, yeah. By the 1860s, anyway, they could.
Right. Well, of course, there's a Catholic emancipation, which I'm going to talk about right here, is that there's a Catholic Emancipation Act at the end of the 1820s. But I believe there were Catholics in the House of Lords, certainly, because there were Catholic lords, particularly in the North. But I'm not sure of that exact, although they were effectively circumscribed, they're effectively forced from power. They didn't have real power.
Well, I bet there are a lot of people that don't realize that in the 1700s, the Irish Catholics couldn't even participate in their own government. Their government was essentially imposed on them from England, and only Protestants were able to play.
And of course, the Protestants were, in other words, so by
it's
the
a
time
minority
you got,
government.
And then it was because of property qualifications, it was a minority government within a minority government. There were many Protestants who couldn't vote because they couldn't. Reach the property qualifications. The pressure against this in 1829, the Test Act of 1672, which basically forced Catholics, kept Catholics from voting and becoming part of the government. In other words, they had to swear an oath to not obey, in other words, that they were effectively Protestant. Mm-hmm. That was repealed, and the Roman Catholic Relief Act was passed after agitation led by Daniel O'Connor. Of course, if you've been to Dublin, you know that O'Connell Street is the main street of Dublin. There's a huge statue of O'Connell there. The Protestants in Ulster tried to stop that, the 1829 Act. They tried to stop it. Their resistance led to a huge property qualification for Catholic voters. In other words, it was only sort of the upper class of Catholics mm-hmm. who could vote. But it led to fears about home rule in Ireland, which there was, as you know, if you've read a Victorian novel,
home
there's
rule.
Constant discussion of home rule for the Irish. And of course, on the one hand, people realized there are many people there who are, a lot like us. On another level, they sort of racially categorized them and, treated them as an inferior form of human being, in part because of their religion. And treated them as a separate people in a sense, even though genetically they weren't. In other words, there were so many English people who had been there, so much going back and forth that they were effectively, particularly in the east of Ireland, very similar. If you looked at them genetically, I think they'd probably be the same.
Brendan, an interesting anecdote showing this English attitude toward the Irish was, you know, Anthony Trollope, one of my favorite novelists, started his career trying to write novels about Ireland. He liked Ireland a lot. He had been stationed there with the post office, which was his official job.
Right.
And he kept writing these Irish novels, and his publishers would tell him, we can't sell these novels. You got to stop writing about Ireland. It's just the English public does not want to read about Ireland.
Right.
So he finally wrote, of course, the Palliser series, in which he has two novels about an Irish politician who comes to England as an MP, member of parliament.
Right.
So it's like he won't give it up. You know, he's going to have an Irishman in his stories.
What you do have is that these upper class Irish men were elected as MPs, and they went to London and served in parliament, sometimes for decades.
Yeah.
Home rule remained controversial. There were, I believe, three efforts in the later half of the 19th century to establish home rule, or into the 20th century. And they all failed in different ways. As we talked about in the episode about the Irish War of Independence, there was one right before the outbreak of World War I, and then they sort of put it off. And they claimed it, historians have claimed it was because of World War I they put it off, but it has to do with the politics of the House of Lords, and there's a whole bunch of sort of, but one of the main political problems with this was the Ulster Protestants were threatening to rebel violently if the home rule was established in Ireland, because they feared, you know, naturally, then they would be the minority, and they didn't want to be the minority. They were terribly frightened about this. In 1913 and 1914, right before the outbreak of World War I, Edward Carson, who was a militant Protestant leader in the North, he began to form what becomes the Ulster Volunteer Force, which has a very, you know...
It sounds bad even now.
Yeah, it has a very sort of not good reputation.
And this was a Protestant group that went around enforcing Protestantism.
And to combat home rule. Home rule. And among other things, they purchased guns from the Germans. Arm themselves, and they form in some. They started to display themselves in groups of 5,000 and 10,000, like appearing at like in public ceremonies, marching around and stuff. You know, I mean, it was clear they're trying to intimidate people and saying, "Hey, if you grant home rule in Ireland, we're going to rebel." And they're not only rebel against Dublin, but they also would rebel against British authority, as strange as it seems. You know,
Brendan, I know there probably no exact figures, but can you give an idea of what percentage of the population was Protestant and what?
Yeah, I can. I actually had the exact figures from the 1911 census, and that leads us. Of course, what happens is that I'll go to those figures just to play it out. Of course, World War I comes, and in the South, they cannot conscript. But in the North, many people do join British forces. And in fact, many Southerners, including Catholics, join British forces that fought. And many of them fought on the Somme. I mean, fought in that terrible fighting there.
When you say they can't conscript in the South, you mean they didn't conscript in the South because Catholic?
They knew that if they did, it would lead to a rebellion.
Yep.
And of course, in the middle of this is the 1916 rebellion, which we've talked about.
Right.
And we'll eventually do an episode on that as well. But we've talked about in the earlier episodes, there was a rebellion in 1916 and in Dublin, and it led to a violent suppression, and people were executed. It creates a crisis. What happens is that after the World War I, British control becomes problematic in the South, and this leads directly to the Irish War of Independence. I did want to give you some statistics, because we do have that. The population of Ireland was around 4,400,000.
Okay.
This is from the census of 1911.
Okay.
About 74% of that number were Catholics. About 3250. In other words, about 3,250,000. The rest, except for a small Jewish population in Belfast and Dublin, when I lived in Ireland in the 1980s, I met Jewish people, and there was a Jewish mayor of Dublin and a Jewish president of Ireland. But I had friends who were members of the Jewish community there, but it was small. Look at that, a couple thousand people. The rest of the population, in other words, over a million, were Protestants, heavily concentrated, about 1.1 million, 1.2 towards 1.2, concentrated in the east of Ireland and especially in the northeast in Ulster.
Okay, so it's three-quarter Catholic and one-quarter Protestant, basically.
Right, essentially. This leads, of course, there's the British authority begins to deteriorate after the war. This leads directly into the War of Independence. The British government decides that in order to make it work, they realize, of course, they're faced with a difficult situation because the people in the north are heavily armed and many of them are combat veterans. They're vocal and militant about not being forced to live, you know, in a Catholic majority society. So the British authorities at that point begin to what they call a temporary division of Ireland. And what they do is that they redraw what the province of Ulster is, because Ulster was nine, as I said, it was nine counties. They basically effectively exclude three traditional Ulster counties from that northern, new northern mini state, which is what it becomes effectively. The counties of Ulster, Donegal, and Cavan. The Ulster counties of Donegal, Cavan, pardon me, and Mohagan were written out essentially of the north. And Ulster
was the motivation behind that?
There were so many Catholics. There were Catholic majority counties.
Okay, so it was just strictly an attempt to get the Protestant majority or closest to the Protestant majority counties into this area and keep the Catholic majorities out.
Right.
But I still don't understand what the purpose of it was. I see now that this is the principle they're using for creating it, but what are they trying to accomplish by doing this?
That's a great question. And I think one thing I had marked this when I was writing up and sort of making little notes is that let's stop and think here for one second about the world we lived in as middle-aged men we grew up in. India and Pakistan, huge problems created by a British division along the same lines. India, there was no Pakistan. Yeah. It was just India, with a Muslim section and a Hindu section, primarily, and some Christians and other groups. Israel and Palestine, the West Bank, divided by the British.
Well, you could lump the entire area of the Arabian Peninsula into that.
Right.
Because the countries of Saudi Arabia, Jordan, those were all British creations too.
Sykes-Picot.
Iraq.
Yeah, Sykes-Picot.
Yeah.
Divisions in South Africa. The difference in Sri Lanka between the Tamils in the north and the Shelhans, if I mispronounce that, in the south. That was more informal, and the division off of Hong Kong, off of China, which was a 19th century creation. That was earlier. But the 20th century creations, those divisions have dominated our lives. Right. And they're associated with, wars. They're associated with nuclear proliferation. Think about that. Israel, Pakistan, right. India, they're nuclear powers because of the divisions in part. These divisions and the division of Ireland, they do this, I think, there's a mixture of intentions. Some of it, I think, is actually well-intended. In other words,
I think so too. There's a kind of logic behind it. If we give people an area where they feel like it's their home,
right,
and they can, unify around their cultural or religious ideas, then that's a good thing. Except when it isn't.
Right. Except when it isn't, and it isn't in many of the cases that they did this. I think that they try to do that. They also were trying to, in the case of Ireland, definitely appease the Unionists, who they saw as being more like them, Protestant, the Scotch-Irish Protestants, effectively. Of course, this division and the historical relationship of Ulster, from the reign of Queen Elizabeth, creates the Scotch-Irish as a kind of distinct people. In other words, they're neither fully Scottish nor fully Irish. They're a distinctive people of Ulster. I would think of them as being Irish, they're Irish. In other words, it becomes a distinctive identity. When they try to bring home rule right before the outbreak, where the heavy fighting in the Irish War of Independence, the British had started talking about two parliaments, one in Belfast and one in Dublin, because they thought, okay, we can't put them together. We're coming up on our second break. We'll be right back. We're the historians.
There's an old New England saying for just about everything in life, but our favorite is this one. Use only the finest 100% Arabica beans. We're the New England Coffee Company, and we've been perfecting the art of coffee roasting for over 85 years. All that experience has created a reputation for exceptional coffee, so that every cup is rich, satisfying, delicious, in the New England tradition. New England Coffee, available at your local supermarket.
This is Mike Jannetty. Join me every Wednesday afternoon from 12 noon to 2 p.m. for DJ Mike Jannetty's Disco Dance Party on WNTN.
All right, we're back. We're the historians. We're talking about Ireland, the coming of troubles in Ireland. Brendan, but before we get back to that story, we have to welcome a new historical sponsor, which is Memphis Nile Water. Now, Brendan, you know that we've been negotiating with a major distributor of spring water located in Maine and a potential historical sponsor. And although those negotiations have stalled due to the state of Maine's pending litigation in the World Court against New Zealand, you know, they're fighting over that giant plastic water bottle island out in the South Pacific to determine who's going to have sovereignty.
Your new obsession with the plastic water bottle island.
I'm obsessed with it. But thankfully, in the middle of that litigation, I'm happy to announce that we have a new historical sponsor also in the H2O business, and it is Akhenaten's Genuine Nile Water, also known as Memphis Nile Water. Now, water happens to be the most important wet stuff on the face of the planet, surpassing even petroleum, soy milk, and Mountain Dew, although not in Arkansas, as a valuable commodity and store of value. And bottled spring water has become immensely popular and expensive in the last 30 years. I mean, a gallon of water often costs more than a gallon of gasoline. Have you ever thought about how strange that is? You know what has to happen to gasoline? They pull oil out of the ground, they move it around the world, they refine it, they have to get it to your gasoline station, and gasoline costs less than a gallon of water. Does that seem strange to you?
It does seem odd. Yes, I have to confess.
All right. Well, the problem with all this purified water is that it removes all the health-giving impurities that keep our immune systems and digestive tracts in top-notch condition. I mean, most people seem to have forgotten that the body has to confront germs in order to prepare to fight them. And that's why Akhenaten's Genuine Nile Water is so valuable. Named after the failed monotheistic pharaoh of the 18th dynasty in Egypt and drawn directly from two of the seven mouths of the Nile, Akhenaten's Genuine Nile Water faithfully provides the human body with everything it needs to build up its resistance to gastrointestinal bugs found all over the ancient and modern worlds. That's not all, because Akhenaten's Genuine Nile Water is also approved for cultic or sacral usage by the priesthoods of Isis, Osiris, Amon-Ra, and somewhat strangely also by the Presbyterian Church. I don't really understand that. Maybe I should do some more research on that. Anyway, the point is that now Americans finally have a third way. The option is not just overpriced faux spring water or chlorinated and sketchy tap water. No, Americans can now choose to experience hydration the way Moses, Cleopatra, and Napoleon did by drinking a somewhat cloudy, lukewarm glass of refreshing Akhenaten's Genuine Nile Water. So look for Genuine Nile Water today wherever precious fluids, bodily or otherwise, are sold, or email fishriverbirdeye@anubis.com.
Nile water. Drink up.
But can you not imagine Napoleon sitting there with his glass of cloudy, lukewarm Nile water, you know, just before he polishes off a bottle of Geoffrey Chambertin, you know? There you go. Thank goodness we've got Akhenaten's Nile Water on board now. We don't have to worry about Poland Springs, whether they come on or not. We'll hope so.
Yes. As I said to you before, the biggest shock to me is that Poland Springs is not in Poland.
It's not in Poland at all.
It's in Maine.
It's very confusing. Very confusing. Okay. So we have now partitioned off these six counties that...
Not fully.
Not fully.
What happened is that in 1920-21, they had drawn this boundary.
All right.
They just excluded the three counties and included basically the counties of Londonderry, as it's called. They argue over the name, Derry and Londonderry. Atrium, Tyrone, Down, Armagh, and Fermagen. Derry and Fermagen were Catholic-dominated counties. They had more Catholics than Protestants, and the city of Derry, which it was the second city of Ulster, of the northern region, was a Catholic majority city, but they included them within the boundaries of these new boundaries of this new Ulster with the six counties.
So they didn't even follow their own principle, which was to separate off the majority Protestant counties from the majority Catholic counties, probably on the idea of this thing needs to be of a certain size to actually function. Right.
To be viable.
But you have given us the absolutely beautiful image of Brits wandering around the globe for 300 or 400 years with maps and laying them down and saying, I say, shall we put a boundary in?
well, this is, I mean, not to go off, but this is also part of the, which we've covered on the show, the boundary dispute between India and China is the McMahon line, which was drawn by the British, I believe, in 1913. But check that. You know, it was a British... Irish, Anglo-Irish guy, I believe, was up there drawing a line.
Every British diplomat or field marshal had a huge magic marker in his back pocket that he pulled out occasionally and said, let's put a line in here. I said, it's beautiful.
What happened is that in the Treaty of 1921, which ended the Irish War of Independence with the freedom of the 26 counties in the South, effective freedom. They were part of the Commonwealth, but they were effectively, and the British controlled two military ports down in Cork. But they were effectively, they had more or less gotten out. They had defeated the British, you know, to a significant degree, enough to drive them out. They had put in an agreement that they would reach, that they would meet in a commission in 1924, 1925, in order to formalize the boundary between Northern Ireland and the South. And the British wrote this thing is this way. Listen to this. Well, each party to the treaty will have a commissioner. There'll be one from the Free State, in other words, the 26 counties. There'll be one from Great Britain, and there'll be one from the North, from Ulster.
Because it's three.
That's three. And of course, the
British have two.
The British have two. the British authorities did this. So the commission met, and they were really planning on altering the border and making population transfers, like altering the border of Southern Armagh, which is heavily Catholic, which is where my family is from, my father's family, which is heavily Catholic, parts of Down, which are heavily Catholic. The Free State was agitating, saying, look, Derry is a Catholic majority city. It's 60-40 almost. You've got to put Derry back in the Republic and connect it to Donegal, which is the original county of Ulster in the north, but they refused to do this. While this was going on, someone leaked these plans about population transfers and changing these borders out into public. And there was a huge uproar both in the Free State and in Ulster and in Great Britain. And effectively, nothing was done. So they left the haphazard border, which they had drawn in 1920 and 21, in place. There's like 250 border crossing places on that border. There's all kinds of it sometimes went right through towns. It went through, people's farms and stuff. I mean, there's going to be a problem.
Just remind our listeners, too, that between this 1921 and 1925, you've got a little problem in Ireland itself. There's a civil war going on.
There was an Irish Civil War. And no, you're right. And I wanted to get in that about the Boundary Commission because it's related to the treaty. But what happens is because the 1921 treaty accepted the separation of Ireland and this creation of this new Ulster, most of the people who had fought against British authority, who had fought in the War of Independence, did not want to accept that. They wanted to keep fighting. But the government realized it would be very difficult to make it work. And how were they going to, how were they going to incorporate these Protestants? There was a lot of tension. This leads to it's a central, if not the central issue of the Irish Civil War. And the Irish Civil War, the Irish Republican Army breaks away from the Free State government. And they fight out the war. And one of their major, if not their major goal, is the continuation of fighting against the British in order to free the northern counties and bring them into a united Ireland.
And if I remember from our previous episode, it was Michael Collins, who had been the hero of the Irish independence movement, who basically says, we're going to accept this division because it's sort of the best we can get. But it leads to this civil war.
It leads to a civil war in which he's killed.
Yeah.
And he's killed. Look, people in the IRA saw him as a traitor. You know, in other words, as two-faced. Like he fought for independence and then he accepted this division, which if you look at a map is pretty, you understand why they were upset. I mean, they'd included all these Catholics in the North. The North was part of a small island, again, you can understand the different emotions, just as you can understand the Protestants fearing being in a Catholic majority
society. And just a counterfactual speculative question. Had they included those majority Catholic counties in the Free State and not in Northern Ireland, do you think it would have stopped the violence?
That gets into a speculative, you know.
That's why I asked it speculative.
Yeah, it is speculative. The short answer to that, probably not. They probably would have kept pressing because there still would have been Catholics there, and there still would have been the sense of our country's been massacred by this colonial power who's been here since the 12th century, but we don't want interfering in our business.
You know, it was interesting when you talked about the idea that they might move people based on their religion, you know, move Catholics out of Northern Ireland into the Free State, et cetera.
Right.
It's exactly what happened at exactly the same time in Turkey and Greece in the 1920s when they transplanted huge populations backwards and forth, and they did it on the basis of religion. They didn't use ethnicity. They didn't use language. The Christians went to Greece and the Muslims went to Turkey.
Right.
They were forced.
And of course, this is what happens when they separate Pakistan and India. There's a horrible wave of violence in 1947, 1948. Many Muslims are expelled who wanted to stay. And of course, India still has a very significant Muslim population. There are killings. It happens. And in the case of Ireland, there was bitter resentment about it. And there was a kind of sense that the revolution, the War of Independence had been betrayed and the 1916 uprising had been betrayed. And many people did not want to participate in the Free State government after that because they thought, okay, we've been betrayed by this treaty. And this does lead to the Civil War. It is about what happens in the North.
Brendan, would it be fair to say that these events between, let's say, 1916 and 1925 continue to be the defining paradigmatic events for kicking off feelings, movements? I mean, this is the moment they're going to keep referring back to over and over and over again.
It's at the center of Irish politics. The two parties, up until the rise of Sinn Féin and ironically, which for reasons which I'll explain in the last of these episodes, what happens to these groups. But the two parties in Irish politics were parties when I lived there. One party had been the party of one party had been the party that accepted the treaty, and one party had been the party that opposed the treaty.
And they had continuity. Those parties had continuity.
Of course, when I lived there, it was still within living memory. Of course, people as children, little children, were now old people, but they remembered it. In fact, I talked to people who remember the Civil War when I lived there, 60 years before, in the mid-1980s. So they had been children at the time. So it was within living memory. That's now changed to a certain degree, but in an ironic way, which I'll discuss in the last episode here about where Irish politics is now in relation to these events. So what you get at that point is there's a large and militant group that is unhappy about what had happened. Many people accepted the Free State, but even those people who accepted the Free State were unhappy about the division, but they weren't unhappy enough to keep fighting and killing other Irish people. This said that the continuation of the division meant the continuation of the IRA, which had never, until the 21st century, had never gone away. There continued to be IRA cells, which incidentally saw themselves as opposed to the government of the Free State because they thought the Free State had sold them out. There were IRA cells. They launched a series of violent campaigns at the end of the 1930s, right at the time of the outbreak of World War II. The IRA was conducting a bombing campaign in Ulster and in Great Britain itself. And that continued, incidentally, right up until the time of the Blitz into 1940.
I don't know, Brendan, about the bombings in this period, but in our lifetime, they frequently targeted major British figures.
Yeah.
Were they doing that in the 1930s, too?
They were actually, their battle plan in that, so to speak, which they did have a plan. It wasn't just random. Their battle plan was to attack, and this was before the outbreak of World War II, was to attack British industrial and military sites in order to try to weaken the British state or make them, take them off balance. I mean, it was a small scale actions, but They also put several, not when it was being used, but they put several bombs in the London tubes, you know, the London right. subway system, but when it was closed, in other words, sort of as a kind of warning thing.
Did they take out Irish politicians that they saw as sympathetic to the Brits or as too tied into the Free State? Were there any?
They did not do that, but there have been times when that was an issue, in other words, particularly during the Civil War, when Irish politicians, there were a series of assassinations at the time of the Civil War.
I remember that from the previous episode.
And there was sort of, they followed this campaign of 1940. Amazingly, they started another campaign in the North in 1942, 44, because American soldiers had arrived and they saw them as just another occupying force. They set off a series of bombs at that time in Ulster. But at that point, the Free State government and the British cooperated in ending that. They're like, no way are we going to antagonize the Americans in this thing. What, are you out of your minds? And they really cracked down hard on them. We're coming up on our third break. We'll be right back. We're the historians.
Here's a fun fact about Demoulas Market Basket. In 2006, Market Basket opened a 500,000 square foot distribution center in Andover, Massachusetts. Weekly, the center receives and ships over 1 million cases of meat, poultry, deli, dairy, seafood, produce, and floral products. Distributing from the center directly to the 80 stores across New England allows Market Basket to maintain such low prices and great deals for our loyal customers. Demoulas Market Basket, more for your dollar.
Join us for a disco dance party every Saturday from 3 p.m. to 6 p.m., hosted by our own DJ PR.
All right, we're back. For information on the historians or any program on WNTN Global Echoes Radio, visit our website, WNTN1550AM.com, and you can reach us at therealhistorians@gmail.com. If you like this show, sponsorships are available. Let us hear from you. We're in the middle of World War II now, Brendan, and there are bombings going on. Americans have shown up. The Irish must have been surprised to find that when those Americans showed up, that half of them were Scots-Irish.
and the other half were Irish Catholics. I mean, Irish, you know, large numbers of them. There also, incidentally, there were that's true. There was also a significant body of African-American troops. They worked on the logistic supply line in the north of Ireland. But it wasn't targeting them necessarily, but it left everyone, both the British government and the Irish Free State government, was very unhappy about that, and they cracked down as hard as they could on them. This led to another campaign, which was the so-called border campaign of the Irish Republican Army in the early 1960s, which is the direct forerunner in a sense of what happens later. They tried to attack the sort of British control of the border between the North and the Irish, by then what's being called the Irish Republic, it's actually not the Irish Republic. Incidentally, the name of Ireland isn't the Republic of Ireland, it's just Ireland. It's just like, Ireland. It's just like Facebook. You know, there's no just Ireland. They started a series of bombings. That campaign failed. And when it failed, the Irish Republican Army became much more doctrinally connected to Marxism and sort of the notion of, instead of this sort of ethnic or, you know, border or, you know, the South versus the North or Catholics versus Protestants, we should create a working class movement across denominational lines that will eventually lead to a united Ireland. And it creates one of the strange things which comes again and again in Irish history, going back to the 18th century, which is the leadership of these nationalist movements were often ideologically divorced from the Catholic population, which is the population most sort of, you know, it's a strange division. I mean, I would just put it that way.
Yeah, I think historically that's not actually so strange, that leaders of movements that profess to be the movements of the lower classes are awfully divorced from them ideologically. I think we can see that in the world we live in today, even, you know.
Right.
But Brendan, I wanted to ask a question about the border. When we get to the 60s, is there a hard border between Northern Ireland and the Irish Free State? I mean, are we talking about like British garrisons of troops along this border?
Not yet.
Okay. Not yet. So you could travel freely back and forth.
There is passport control. You know, there is, you know, in other words, but there were a ton of informal, you know, border crossing areas, which people, everything that everyone has ever told me, they went back and forth. But there were areas where, like, if you were on a main road, you were going to be stopped and have to go through some kind of passport control. And they used different currencies. Obviously, they used what was called the punt, popularly when I was there in the South, and they used British sterling, you know, British pounds in the North. There were different currencies to different countries. Mm-hmm. The failure of the border campaign at this time, and sort of this brings us up right to the period where, you know, that leads directly into what we call the Troubles. There began in the mid-60s, sort of into 67, 68, the creation of a civil rights movement in Ireland, led by Catholics and demanding equal civil rights. At this point, now you're that many years after division, effectively, many Catholics could not vote because of the way the laws had been written. You had to be the head of a household to vote or a business mm-hmm. owner. And because they were being discriminated against economically and in terms of home loans, they could not vote. The Protestant majority also gerrymandered districts, just as we do in America between Republican and Democrat. They created districts, you know, that sort of try to exclude Catholics from office. Many Catholics were not homeowners. The poverty in Ireland in the early 1960s was considered the worst poverty in the Catholic population, was considered the worst poverty in Western Europe wow. of any group. Yeah,
that's hard to believe.
Yeah, and many of those homes, incidentally, not either people couldn't afford homes. They were living in small flats with large families. And some of those flats and some of those homes had no running water. They didn't have, you know, they had outhouses.
Brendan, was Northern Ireland, could you say Northern Ireland was significantly better off economically from the Irish Free State?
Yes, they were. At that time, the Irish Free State was, at that time, it's Ireland. It's no longer the Free State, it's just okay. Ireland. But at that point, Ireland was a poor, when I lived there in the 1980s, it was a poor agrarian society with most people living in the countryside. The farmers had a lot of the money. In other words, people who owned land, who owned significant farms, were a significant economic class. The North still had significant industrial works, although they were in decline by the end of the 1960s as well, because of the beginnings of globalization, particularly the rise of the East Asian industrial powers had begun. They were in economic decline for sure, but they were far better off. The Protestants ascribed the Catholics' poverty not to their own laws and exploitation, but for the Catholics being bad, being lazy. So these civil rights, they formed a group called the Northern Ireland Civil Rights Association. But I do want to end here, but I want to make something clear to our listeners. The goal of that group was equalities for Catholics within the North. It was not for a united Ireland. It was for equal rights and equal votes and equal economic opportunity for the Catholics living in the North. In other words, stopping the discriminatory behavior towards them. All kinds of different people were involved, but it started out as a peaceful movement. Mm-hmm. But over time, as we'll see in our next episode about this, that fell apart. And, you know, for a variety of reasons, which I'll talk about, they staged marches and they were initially peaceful. Some of them, although people, I think, do overstate this, but they did look at the American civil rights movement and Martin Luther King and modeled some of what they were doing on what they were doing. Yep. And in fact, yep. in one famous episode, one famous incident before the violence starts, they actually sang "We Shall Overcome," you know, and these sort of songs associated wow. with the American civil rights movement.
Yeah.
But I think I want to stop there with the formation All right. of the Northern Ireland Civil Rights Association, their beginning of sort of peaceful marches. We're going to pick it up there, and we'll see how that turned into basically a 30-year war or All a 20-year, right. 22-year war, 20, depending on how you want to define it.
Yeah.
It turned into a guerrilla war. I think stopping right there, we are now up on our continuing feature, This Week in Historical News.
This Week in Historical News, I don't know if I even want to hear it this week. But now, what do you
got? Since we're beginning with obituaries, you probably don't want to hear it.
You always do. You always bring me down with all these obituaries. Okay, what do we got going on here?
First of all, I did want to call people's attention to the death around Christmas time of Casey Jones, former coach of the Celtics, former Boston Player. Celtic,
yeah,
much admired man. He won, I think, seven championships playing
as a player. Oh, okay.
As a player, he also won two as a coach. He was an Olympic gold medalist, and he also played at the University of San Francisco, which I think won the NIT. He had just a fabulous run. I think the nicest. I mean, of course, I remember him quite well as a player and a coach. people talked about how modest and sort of easy, you know, he was going, and also extremely knowledgeable about basketball. But I believe it was Larry Bird or Kevin McHale. But I think Larry Bird said, quite frankly, when they asked him, you know, what he thought about Casey Jones, they said, well, what, is a coach or something? He goes, I don't want to talk about him as a coach. All I can say is that when I look at Casey Jones and the way he conducted himself, I always wish I was the kind of man he was, which I thought was about the highest praise you could ever say about another man, that you wish you were as good a man as he was in terms of just being a very strong human being. Also dead, John Le Carré, the
Ray.
What?
You talking about the author?
Yeah. Le Carré. Okay.
Yeah,
McCray?
That's right. Yeah.
The author who wrote Cold War novels.
Yeah.
And of course, he basically defined the Cold War for people in many respects with his fiction, especially Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy.
Right.
And my thing, yeah, that's...
Yeah, didn't Alec Guinness play that character?
Yes, I believe Alec Guinness, one of his, another great performance.
Yeah.
But
my dad used to read his novels.
He was just really effective, and much of what people thought about the Cold War was shaped by him.
Yep.
And I think that's fair to say. He has passed away. Also, Dawn Wells.
No.
Dawn Wells, yes.
The curse of Gilligan's Island strikes again.
Again, yes. Gilligan's Island. Mary Ann from Gilligan's Island has passed away.
Brendan, were you a Mary Ann guy or a Ginger guy?
I think it was more of a Mary Ann guy.
Yeah, I was too until I got about 18 or 19.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, yeah. Takashi passed away. Who was that person? He was a journalist who wrote and shaped opinion very broadly about, among, you know, the sort of political class, about Japan, as Japan rose from being this defeated country in World War II to being this economic powerhouse in East Asia, the rise of the East Asian industrial powers. He passed away. He wrote for the New York Times. He wrote for, I believe, several other publications as well. I cannot sort of overstate his importance to creating. He did a lot to create the sort of understanding of Japan that, you know, sort of shaped America in the 1980s.
Was he a Westernizer or an anti-Westernizer? You say one or the other?
I wouldn't put it that way. You know, discuss him on that axis.
Showing my ignorance.
He basically understood that Japan had changed dramatically because of the war, that the militarized side of Japanese society, which had been, of course, dominant or extremely significant, had no longer, you know, a free expression. And this relates to the industrialization. Coming up again, because we've been away for a while, this stuff has piled up, but I did want to mention one more obituary, Chuck Yeager, the famous pilot, the person who broke the sound barrier. When he died, I remember I emailed you and I read some accounts of his life and said, I feel inadequate as a man after I read about what he accomplished by the time he was 30, you know? I mean, just an incredible figure. Of course, the movie The Right Stuff is in large part about him. If anything, his life was even more dramatic than what was portrayed on the screen.
Yeah.
It's just, he was a World War II fighter ace. He flew in Korea. He broke the sound barrier. He was just an unbelievable and very sort of dramatic figure. We are coming up on the end of the show. We are coming up on the end of the show.
Well, ending with Chuck Yeager is a fairly...
I think I want to end there. I don't want to continue because I just think he's such an iconic figure of that World War II generation, which is now passing away, and of the generation that made our initial thrust into space, which, of course, really leads to this fantastic achievement at the end of the 1960s, the landing on the moon. But I did want to say, we're back. We're ready for action. We'll be going forward with our account of Ireland and our updates on the world news situation as we go forward. We'll be back soon. We're the historians. Thank you.
We'll be right back.